Okay, hello there, everyone. Welcome to Open Sources Guelph on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz from the CFRU news team here on February 29th, a rare occasion for us. Maybe not as rare as an eclipse. I used to work with a guy. We used to have to spend the whole day trying to convince him that the day was real, because he'd be like, today's not real. Like, what do you mean today's... What do you mean today's not real?
I didn't know you worked with Alec Jones.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe he went that direction. I haven't seen this guy in years, but I think it should be a holiday. I think we should just all have it on. Just shut everything down like Christmas, you know?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I wish to subscribe to your newsletter.
Some folk are getting paid, so, you know, maybe we should just shut her down.
Yeah, no, I like that idea. It's not like we're not used to things shutting down now. So, like, since the last leap day, right? So, it's, I think we could do
millimeter
it
of a millimeter of snow. Close her down. No buses.
That's right. Alrighty, Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can find us here every Thursday, not just leap days, at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians, which this week will be Faye Johnstone, a trans activist and the executive director of the Society for Queer Momentum. And they are going to tell us about how they meaning Faye, is maintaining hope as the trans community across Canada is facing increased pressures from governments and parental rights groups. And Faye is also going to tell us why they think we are still on the progressive road to equality. And we certainly hope so. But that's at the bottom half of the hour. And before that, we're going to talk about a few news items from the last week. And they are both out of Queen's Park. And we're going to start with this announcement on Monday that... I don't know if it's a top-up, but I'm going to call it a top-up, a $1.3 billion top-up to Ontario's post-secondary institutions, colleges, and universities. I wasn't aware of this, but apparently 10 Ontario universities are teetering on the brink of deficits. And of course, we live in Ontario, and only the Ontario government is allowed to run a deficit. So this announcement from Jill Dunlop, who's someone we don't usually get a lot of big star-making announcements from, seems to, at least in the short term, solve, or maybe not solve, but address some concerns about lack of post-secondary funding. But as we all know, the devil's in the details.
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, there are some strings in there by the sounds of it. But just to get to the raw numbers of the money first off, I mean, this is... in the wake of a report that the government sanctioned that saying that there's an extra, not an extra, but $2 billion are required to get to the level of funding that they need for post-secondary in Ontario. And currently the amount they're putting in is five. So this will bring it up to six, just shy of $6 billion total. Mm-hmm. It's weird to talk about such large numbers. So matter-of-factly, like, well, you know, $6 billion, $7 billion, but every bit of it counts, but it's funny how this cash just kind of magically appears in the wake of the feds announcing the cap on international students, which is the gravy, not gravy train, just this just this is gravy. Where revenue, the revenue source that they're relying on right now. Mm-hmm. So is this to own the libs, capital L, or was this actually a well-planned out thing? But since they've been holding back on cash for so long, you know, this is the magic money just appears. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and to keep in mind, I mean, when you're talking about billions of dollars, you're like, well, that's a large sum of money, and don't they have enough? But you know, the present funding comes down to about, and I did the back of the envelope math, but it's like $1,300 per student.
Hmm.
In across all the post secondary institutions, or something like $954,000 students enrolled in post-secondary institutions around Ontario. So when it's all said and done, that's about $1,300 extra per student. And, you know, $1,300 that might buy all your textbooks for the year. But I'm not 100% sure, because I haven't been in university in 20 years, at least as a student. But yeah, it's you were kind of scratching at something too, that Ontario like a lot of things, Ontario spends the least out of any Canadian province on post-secondary. We're at the bottom. 44% of Ontario colleges are underfunded compared to the rest of Canada. 57% of universities are underfunded compared to the rest of Canada. And keep in mind, too, tuition free since 2019, so that's 5 years. Now, that there was a pandemic in between, so it, you know, there was probably some cost savings for universities not having campuses open and not having to staff the, you know, all the ancillary businesses and stuff. I mean, there was certainly some loss of productivity, of course, but it just seems like this has been, I guess, something that hasn't been on the front burner for a long, long time. Actually, I don't think there's been anything really proactive on universities and colleges and student choice after that imploded. It just seemed like the government was like, okay, well, we're done fiddling with this for a while, and then they just didn't get back to it until the feds brought the boot down on international students, and now it's a crisis. I mean, it's always been a crisis, and that's that report you said, like, they were recommending like drastic things, like increasing funding by 10% and increasing tuition by 5%, like right away. Dunlop apparently was originally proposing like 5% increase over 3 years, but Doug Ford put the kibosh on that. And it's so funny. Brian Lilly's like, that's our populist premier at work. And it's like, well, it's, you know, I would be very surprised if Doug Ford would ever get behind an increase of any kind. Because of like, even like that sort of like bait, we'll get to the politics of appearances in a bit, but like that base sort of like populist reflex is very real and quite in tune with Doug Ford. So he was never going to go for that. But I mean, that's how kind of how dire the situation is that you had a blue ribbon panel, the best kind of panel, recommending 10% increase in investment, 5% increase in tuition. So, you know, when you look at things like that, that's, you know, drop in the bucket. You hate to say $1.3 billion, it's a drop in the bucket, but it's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, and they love the freeze, the language of the freeze. We hear it all the time, right? Freeze the tax, freeze this, freeze that. And that's good for the students. I mean, I would, you know, in my perfect world, post-secondary education would be free for the most part.
Mm.
I personally think that it should be. In this universe, our universe currently, and maybe ever, that's just not going to happen. So we need to be realistic about it. But also being realistic about it is where does the money come from? You are supposed to be funding this. And we see this. You mentioned the failed student choice initiative. I think some of the details in this speak to that. It's not exactly a workaround, but they put in some conditions in the legislation, like they want the cost of textbooks, which you mentioned, and learning materials to be transparent. Now, a lot of that exists in parallel or outside of what the institutions do. And the price of textbooks for a year, we bitched about it when we were students. They still do, right? It's a separate cycle, right? But and also creating transparency, as they're calling it, on tuition fees. It's like, well, you can find that. You can find at Guelph and other institutions, you can find an intense breakdown yourself on how tuition is broken down. Now, how much do they want to split that up? There's this implication from this language that the institutions are doing something wrong. And will it be, you're spending too much money on woke things, you should spend it on, you know, that's where
absolutely.
I think. Well, that's what I think.
That's coming. That's coming.
Yeah, that's where it's going to go. And that the intention of the student choice initiative, right? Make it sound like it's something positive. We're finding efficiencies is another one, right? But it's like they want to find these efficiencies somehow by getting rid of certain things that they don't like, or being able to analyze these things that they don't necessarily need to do. What's needed is an injection of money into the system. And we're seeing it. We're seeing the results of failed legislation as well up at York U, who are on strike.
Mm-hmm.
You hear about it just at the kickoff, and then we haven't heard anything for the rest of the week, but the details are the same. It's like from Bill 124, wages were frozen at 1%. A lot of the workers up there are living on fumes. Yeah. This is academics too, right? The academic workers, TAs, grad assistants, contract faculty, right? I think part-time library in there. And, you know, here is the results of that. It's like, this isn't fixed. With all the tinkering.
No,
they tried to do, it's not right. It's Kathleen Wynne's fault, right?
Well, I'm
being facetious. It's not Kathleen Wynne's, but that's what it'll be. You know, the liberals for years, they didn't do anything. It's like, well, what have you done, Doug?
I'm also not saying it's not Kathleen Wynne's fault. Because, I mean, there's certainly things that were done during the liberal, 15 years of liberal government that was sort of like kicking the can down the road.
Oh, for sure. But defaulting to that now is just gone. Like, we don't believe, sure, after the number of years you've been in, we just don't believe you anymore.
Yeah, he's been in office for 5.5 years.
Yeah,
but the thing of it is, too, I think this is one of these big problem things that would help if we could, like, put everything on the table, because there are things that universities do, and we see it at the University of Guelph, too. Not to bite the hand that feeds, necessarily, but, you know, things like building gateways, you know, taking the intersection on campus and turning it into a gateway, and expanding the C-suite and having senior executive vice presidents of, you know, bum picking or whatever. It's sorry to be so I'm getting a little crotchety hippie in my old age, but no, it's, you know, again, I'm sure that everybody is doing a great job and all these roles are important, but like, there has been such an expansion on the fifth floor of the university center for years of people with like big fancy job titles. And I just, and this is happening at other universities too. Ryerson is not Ryerson, TMU, was recently dinged for that. So there's a lot going on here. It's like, where is the money going? I think that is sort of a fair question. Another fair question is how much of our post-secondary system should be about education and how much should be about job creation, and how do you decide where to fit and when to go? And this maybe speak to some of your flexibility with it, because if you had the flexibility of having a free or nearly free post-secondary system, you could go to university and get that education, and then maybe you could go to college and get that job training or some combination thereof. But I got to tell you, we're not going to get that from this government, which just sort of fundamentally wants to, you know, get the flex tape out and patch the hole and walk away and go on to the next thing. Like, that's essentially who Doug Ford is that guy from the flex tape commercial. He's just got a big roll of flex tape that he's going to slap on holes to make the water stop pouring out.
Yeah, because it's everybody else's fault. And sure, you know, and mentioning jobs and careers there, that's a part of it as well, that they want to, what did they call it, a portal of some kind to help the students understand what the labor market's all about. Is that going to fix it? Mm-hmm. Is that the purpose? I mean, it is the purpose a lot in college, but at the university level, and, you know, I've been griping for years about the, let's call it, liberal studies being diminished, like just the for general, sure, all around education that you're supposed to leave a post-secondary institution with. It's not just about getting a job. It helps,
yeah,
for sure. It has, sure, helped.
Yeah.
Although we're seeing in this decade, and maybe the one previous too, that it doesn't necessarily help.
Yeah.
However much you plow into your degree does, yeah, not help you in the raw job market, right?
Yeah.
You don't necessarily leave. Well, I mean, I came here to study agriculture, and look at where I am. But I will say that back in the day, because they were looking for people to get involved with agriculture, and they're doing it again, was heavily subsidized. I'm, yeah, not even going to mention what I paid in tuition, because it's going to make, it would make people angry. Even indexed inflation.
No, me too. Yeah.
Even indexed, yeah, inflation, it was, yeah, cheap. I got to say, it was cheap, right?
Yeah.
And that was part of, I have to be honest about it, part of the reason why I came.
Yeah.
But with that, a whole bunch of other stuff went as well. It wasn't just learning about farming, right?
Right. No, it's, these are like very important questions, I think. You know, and in this too, is like, I think there's a practical expectation for young people that, you know, when you're 18 or you're 17 or 18, you need to know what's the job you're going to do, what education you need to get it, and what pre-qualifications you need in order to get into that education in order to get that job. that's a lot to put on a young person. It's just we kind of have, you know, we live in this world where everybody's expected to change careers like six times before they retire, if they get to retire.
Yep.
But at the same time, we expect the young people to have their future figured out at 15, 16 as well. It just there's something about those two facts or those two levels of expectations that's just not going to hold. But I mean, that's also probably more than what our provincial government or any provincial government is capable of figuring out. Meanwhile, our provincial government is having trouble figuring out about conflicts of interest. Because the other big news out of Queen's Park this week is a story from the Toronto Star that Brock Vanderick and Matthew Bundy, two lobbyists who used to work in the premier's office, were appointed to this these positions on this judicial review committee, which appoints judges. Don't take my word for it. Doug Ford got up in question period Wednesday and said, not only am I doubling down, not only am I tripling down, I'm quadrupling down. And I'm sure Thursday he's quintupling down, and then on Saturday I'll be septupling down. But again, in politics, if it looks bad, it is bad. And Doug Ford has decided to learn that lesson the hard way again.
I felt like he was trying to sell me a car or something. I'm not doubling down. I'm not tripling down. I'm quadrupling down. Yeah, what was his other comment to the NDP? He was like, you guys are so weak, it makes me sick. Like, what? Where is Brilliant. This coming from?
Great stuff. Great stuff. Great normal stuff you hear from him.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the opposition's job to do what they're doing. And yet it's like, oh. And this goes back a little bit to topic one in terms of this. The approach that they have in terms of just ramming her through without thinking it through too much, without taking a step back and saying, you know, people might think this is a bit, I don't know. And the NDP did, right away, I'm like, this is the American style, because they seem to think they can do it like the American president. It's like president decides, Supreme Court. This is not Supreme Court level, right? This is more like circuit court judge level, Superior Court in Ontario, right? This is, but... And then he's saying, oh, I wouldn't pick Liberal NDP people. The point, the reason why we do these things by committee up here is to get a fair and balanced somebody behind the desk who is fair and balanced. But again, this is not the main problem. This is deflect, distract kind of stuff. The problem is the system, the legal system right now, is completely slammed and has been for years. What's the key problem in the legal system in Ontario right now? It's staffing shortages, getting people's cases through in a reasonable amount of time, and that's not happening. So what happens? It's your constitutional right to get, you know, a case through right away or within a reasonable period of time. And if it doesn't, it gets chucked out. And his comments about bail and all of that stuff that he was harping on or spouting off about, the report, just when did that report drop? Today or yesterday, was saying that 80% of people in Ontario jails are awaiting bail.
He sounded like a hanging judge, right? He's like, I want, you know, they're going to bust into your house and they're asking, they're out on bail. And, you know, he's doing the Doug Ford thing. And it's just like, dude, you're not appointing hanging judges. This isn't Deadwood, South Dakota in the 18, whenever that was, you know, when Seth Bullock rides into town and... Huh. You know, there's laws, there's expectations, there's guidelines for how people are sentenced and who ends up on bail and how much bail they pay. It's like, I'm like, are you expecting somebody just like walk into court with like a paddle or something? And like, I don't know what his expectations is, you know, and here we are again, sort of at the intersection of sort of Doug Ford, hanging judge, and Doug Ford, who has his family's been involved in some criminal justice stuff. Let's put it that way. So you think he might have some sympathy. So it's completely weird. And you're right. The American style part of this, and I'm starting to feel like a lot of our problems in Canada is that we've like let Americanness affect us. So it's like, well, I'm not going to appoint some NDP or Liberal. It's like, that's not the point. You're supposed to supposed to appoint the best person for the job, which is why these are decided by independent bodies instead of, you know, patronage appointments. and you know, people who worked in your campaign and people you worked in your office. This isn't a situation where you come in as premier and you fill like 4,000 government vacancies, like, you know, when the new person is elected at the White House. That's not how this works. We have a career civil service for this very reason. No matter who is at the top, their job is to execute with the best advice, best practices, best new information, and to present you options that you then decide to execute based on your party ideology or personal ideology or whatever it is that brought that government in power. It is not your job to fill vacancies in the career civil service with your guys, which is what, and you know, on top of this, it should note that neither Bundy or Vandrick have done anything wrong. But strangely, Bundy was a lobbyist. He worked in the premier's office and he was a lobbyist. And the firm he was working for was lobbying on behalf of Colt Canada, which makes guns for the Canadian forces. They have a factory in Kitchener, of all cockamamie places, you know, bring it close to home. So it's, you know, there was a report in CTV News on Wednesday that, you know, that apparently he was had a meeting as a lobbyist with the government as early as last week. And again, none of this is illegal. It just looks bad and it smells bad. And, it, you know, in so much as we want to point and laugh at America for their the gaping gaps in their conflict of interest policies, you know, we have some of those here, too. But I feel like that's sort of where we are now, is that we're letting this American silliness affect us to uncomfortable degrees.
Well, I mean, even if you wanted to appoint somebody who was conservative.
Sure.
Is the pool that thin that he can't find somebody that isn't a lobbyist, like you mentioned, or somebody that didn't just come out of his office? There has to be somebody out there. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are members of the Conservative Party in Canada, but instead he goes directly to these guys and it smacks patronage and partisan stuff. And all of that stuff that he said before he got elected the first time, that was the problem with the government that they replaced. Oh, they appoint all of their friends. They, everything that he said, you could play that and sort of, you know, tweak the voice to be somebody else. It's like, this is you. You're talking about yourself.
Yeah, it's the meme.
You're talking about yourself when you were elected to this. You've done everything that you said you were not going to do. Every single thing.
You become your own worst enemy.
Exactly. When does it end? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, it's the guy. It's the meme of the guy in the hot dog outfit. Yeah, we got to find out who's doing this.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's also like, I feel like these are unforced errors too. Like, no one told him to appoint these guys. Like, he just appointed them. And then, you know, and then when it's pointed out, instead of saying, you know what, you're right, we're not doing anything wrong, but you know what, it does look bad. We're going to leave them in place, but we promise for the next ones, we're going to make better. We're going to, you know, cast a wider net or do whatever you have to do to make it right. He can do that so easily, and he would get the points for being magnanimous, for being generous, but he just can't do it. And instead he has to make it about, I don't know if it's because NDP is led by a woman or what it is, like, just like, you guys make me sick, or like, your voice is like nails on a chalkboard. It just, like, these like ad hominem attacks too, it just, it's such a bad look. And these are, again, these are unforced errors. He could stop himself before he screws up this bad.
Well, this is the thing with the gauges with Ford. If he's getting pissed off when you're questioning him about stuff, and the more defensive he is, you know that the problem is worse.
Mm-hmm.
You could almost, like the clap meter, right? You could, the more angry that Doug Ford is with the media, then you know that he has probably done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's my gauge. Because I was about to say double down, but I guess I should now say quadruple down, because that's entered the entered the language now. Like,
yep, that's right.
It's he's obviously not going to back away from it, but it's not going to make it right. So
no, it's not going to make it right. And TGIT, thank goodness it's Thursday, because they don't have the legislature in session on Friday.
I'm sure
Doug is glad anyway. We're going to take a quick break and come right back with our interview this week. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
And there's some new music, or newish music, out of Austin, Texas. The band is called, and I did pick them for the name, Large Brush Collection. I wasn't sure if it was toothbrushes or like leaves at the side of the road, but anyway,
sure,
might find out one day. The album's called Off Center, and the song title is Forgiveness is a Gift We Give Ourselves.
Hmm.
Words of wisdom there from the Large Brush Collection.
Yes, for sure, even though we don't know where the brush is or what the brush is. But we'll figure it out. We're going to have an in-depth report next week. No, we're not. For this week, though, for our interview, we reached out to Faye Johnstone, who is a well-known trans activist. They are themselves a trans woman, and they're the executive director of the Society for Queer Momentum. You've probably seen Faye in just about any story about trans rights in Canada. They are very, very visible. And it was about this time last year, and we get into this in the interview a bit. Hershey did this promotion. She, Her for She, which was gathering five women together to celebrate International Women's Day, and I guess the power of chocolate, question mark. Hmm. And Faye Johnstone was one of those people. And wouldn't you know, they were inundated with online hate for having the audacity of accepting a chocolate bar. So Faye has been in the trenches. And we're getting their perspective on all the stuff that's happening in Canada right now. Parental rights, people out there protesting about trans visibility in schools, washroom access, all of this stuff. Faye is a lot of fun to talk to. They are very passionate, obviously, because they are a trans woman. And, well, I guess I've probably psyched us up for the interview. So we'll just press play on that. And here's Faye Johnstone, live-ish from Ottawa. Okay, Faye Johnstone, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to talk about you naturally, but I'm realizing that you're kind of a face of the LGBTQ plus community in Ottawa and around Canada. I know that a lot of people probably come to you and to talk about their concerns about what they're hearing in the media, what they're hearing in the community. So, I mean, obviously, without betraying confidences, just, you know, what does it feel like for people who identify as trans or people who identify as queer right now as they're sort of going about their daily lives? You know, what's kind of keeping them up at night?
You know, I think we've come a really long way in the last 20 and 30 years, and that's incredible. So more than ever, queer and trans folks, they're just like living their lives. They got the same concerns that all Canadians do, and that's paying our bills, putting food on the table, and raising our families. But there is this social environment that still hasn't really, you know, come as far as we might want it to be. You know, when we think about the progress that we've made, there's still that like longstanding inequality that doesn't go away overnight. And right now, I think folks are really scared because we're seeing the warning signs of the world taking a step backwards on our rights and our dignity. So I hear from folks who are worried, who are more scared just to live their lives and be themselves. Because when you see headlines that dehumanize us, when you see like rhetoric that is really well crafted, but that targets our dignity and our humanity, that actually trickles into the social sphere. So when you're walking to the coffee shop, you're more likely to have, you know, strangers look at you oddly or react to you in a stigmatizing manner, simply because of what they're seeing, what they're reading, what they're hearing about trans people in particular, but all queer folks.
Right. And I want to tie together two of the things you kind of brought up there. One is like sort of the economic piece of this. People are concerned about affordability, you know, having a place to live, having a good paying job. And a lot of the people who are sort of like speaking to those issues right now are also people who are talking in negative ways about supporting people who are trans, supporting the queer community. The two are kind of tied together. And as we're sort of looking at maybe an election sometime this year federally, elections all over the country, frankly, whether it's provincial or local level, people who are speaking to and economic anxiety are also the same people who are speaking to creating that fear of the queer community as well. And that's kind of, I feel like there's a Venn diagram there we don't really tackle too often.
And I think, you know, it is difficult in this situation because Canadians are struggling, right? Like everything is more expensive. That is especially hitting working class and low wage workers. But the politics that are being pushed by these conservative, and they largely are conservative politicians, like Pierre Poilievre, the approach underlying both economic and social issues is one of rage, anger, and division. And that's what's at the root of it. You know, I am the first to say our current government needs to do more on the cost of living, on the housing crisis, and also on the queer and trans and social issue stuff, to be real. But it's the strategy that conservatives are using that actually worries me most is the anger politics. Mm-hmm. But I also think that they're tapping in and taking advantage of a lot of disinformation about the experiences of trans people. They're really framing transness as something that is like middle class, as people who are, you know, extremely right. privileged. And that's actually the opposite of what we know about trans people. Trans people are more likely to be in low wage jobs than the average Canadian, more likely to actually be homeless or to have that dream of a home further out of sight for them. And so my worry here is that we need to tackle the economic issues, but when we're talking about those issues, we're actually predominantly, we're talking about a lot of queer and trans people who are struggling more than other people because there is still like a pink ceiling and a pay gap. And it's dangerous for politicians to punch down on us in that particular context.
That's a really great point. Trans people are often on, because of their visibility, are often sort of the victims of economic disparity or equal access to services that, everyone wants equal access to. I remember last fall and, you know, you were obviously taking part in some of these counter protests to the, what was it again? The 1 million March for Children.
Million man march for children.
Yes. I seem to remember, at least here locally in Guelph, there was this idea that this was the start of a movement and that it would be like every couple of weeks, every month, there would be a big gathering. That didn't seem to happen over the course of the winter. And I'm wondering, from your point of view as an activist and an advocate, does that make this sort of like, is that a sign of hope for you? Or is that kind of like something scary that it's not kind of out in the open as it was back in September and October?
So I think I struggle, right? Because I think we got to remember that the actual number of folks in Canada pushing for these anti-trans, anti-gay policies are like a fraction of a fraction. Most folks, if you're ranking what they care about politically, this is going to be the lowest on the list. And so I think what they've done is they've used a lot of misinformation and fear mongering to get out crowds at that Million Man March event. But I think a lot of it to me is less the worry about those and more politicians taking advantage of this particular moment for their own, you know, cynical politics. And we're seeing that the organizing bodies behind some of those anti-gay and anti-trans marches, they're also actually quite influential in conservative spaces. So when we look at Alberta, for example, you know, Danielle Smith introduced these anti-trans policies, not because she discovered some problem. If you notice the problem, a responsible premier would say, let's investigate this, let's talk to parents and teachers and young folks and doctors. And she did none of that.
Right.
What we're actually seeing is a premier who's being pressured by those social conservatives. And if she wants to stay in power, she needs to throw them a bone. And trans people, unfortunately, in 2024, it's easier to throw us to the dogs than it is to throw gay folks or to throw women's reproductive rights. And so we're an easy target for her to shore up those conservative votes.
And this leads to, I imagine, a difficulty on your part and the part of other activists in that you're fighting the real fight against real bigotry, but you're also having to fight against, I guess, this reflexive bigotry. This kind of soft bigotry where we have to pretend to be bigots because we want to win those votes.
Exactly that. And we're engaging with a lot, like the conservative or the far right comms machine is a behemoth, right? Like, the amount of times that I've been maligned or near slandered or even explicitly so by, you know, far right media publications, by some of these bigger heads is deeply concerning, in part because I'm actually very confident in our policies, in our position on this. I am also a gal who loves dialogue. And so I want us to find the solution in our schools that support young folks and their families to thrive, that make sure we have the robust healthcare system for trans kids and all young folks and all peoples that everyone deserves. But they're slinging a whole lot of mud, which taps into a legacy of stigma. And it means that the water is poisoned from day one. Because we're not actually talking about, you know, trans kids and healthy schools and evidence-based policies. We're talking about sloganeering and policymaking with a bludgeon of a term like parental rights. And that hides the lack of evidence and consultation under these policies, too.
And they lead into the sort of the extremist bits, and we've sort of seen, and I guess we've probably kind of laughed at it too, maybe we shouldn't, but at least clips of people at school boards in the United States reading, you know, sex scenes from books that are aimed at, you know, teenagers, and, you know, them sort of leaning into the most, I guess, kind of offside material, as opposed to maybe just focusing on questions about why young people who may be confused about their gender identity or their orientation might seek out those materials too.
And I think there's a whole lot of hypocrisy here, right? Like, you know, books, literature that has, you know, themes around sexual violence, themes around sexuality, when it's applied to straight people, there's very rarely a push to ban those books, but then they cherry pick a passage in something that's by or about queer and trans people, and then they harp on us. And then there's the irony of they talk about freedom of expression, and then they try to ban books, and then they try to cancel folks like myself who are speaking out and fighting for a more free, equal, and socially just future for our communities. And so it's like, it's these things where, like, they're all for parent rights, but they didn't talk to parents about these policies, right? Like, the ironies and the hypocrisies here should really be just concerning to anybody who wants good government and sound public policy.
And I guarantee, being a former 10-year-old boy myself, you've never read anything in a book that you haven't already heard on a schoolyard.
Like, I swear, like, children, just like, we need to protect children. We need to support kids to thrive. But like, 13 and 14-year-olds are already accessing all sorts of information we probably wouldn't want them to access. We actually need to give them the skills to assess, to put it, like, to analyze, to understand. And that's actually exactly what sex ed is all about. The right. Same sex ed that Premier Danielle Smith is now making an opt-in only program in Alberta.
I think it, you know, it started with sex ed. I remember here in Ontario, maybe you remember it too.
Oh, like, yeah. Back during Ford back in his place. It was a good time.
But, you know, I think it was around 2015 that the new sex ed curriculum was introduced, and there were all these protests about, like, what the sex ed curriculum said and what it didn't say. And I think, you know, it starts from this kind of very puritanical place. And I wonder if we've just kind of, I don't know if trans people in Ontario or in Canada just have sort of become that face, have become a visible place to which to put that. Like, you, the trans people have literally become a straw people on this issue, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
And it is exactly that. Like, we, and the annoying part is that it's easier to do it to us because, like, I love my community. We look a little bit more different on average than our, like, cisgender gay pals, or than most straight people do. Like, I am very well aware. I am 5'11", deep voice, broad shouldered trans gal. I'm still built like a hockey jock. Thanks, military family. And so we do tend to confront a lot of folks' like latent stigma and concern. And that is all, you know, we can analyze that. That is, you know, decades of misogyny and patriarchy and homophobia and all of that. But it means that we're easy to malign because there's a lot of that in the atmosphere. And so they have indeed, they've taken all of their anxiety. Social conservatives have turned trans people into a trope and a symbol of all of the things bad in society. When again, my folks are just trying to pay their bills, live their lives, and raise their families. And that, again, is like, trans folks are not a political ideology. We're just folks who have a different gender than a whole bunch of folks thought we did, trying to do the thing of being human and living our lives.
I ran into somebody at one of those Million Man Marches back in the fall who he said he was gay, but he was with the Million Man Marchers. And I'm wondering from your point of view, is this common? Like, because we have a political class that's sort of exploiting, I guess, the differences between trans people and cis straight people. Is it also sort of exploiting, I guess, camaraderie and allyship within the queer community itself? Or are you seeing that?
So I think it's, this is often, I would argue, a framing from anti-gay and anti-trans groups, right? Where they're trying to say, well, look at these gay people who are also likely to be far right, to be COVID conspiracy theorists, to be misogynists, and use them to say, oh, no, those trans folks, they're radicals. They're not the good gay people. And that's actually something that has happened in social movements for decades, if not centuries, where, you know, anti-rights groups will use the one gay person who says homophobic or supports homophobic policies to try to break or create an impression of division. And that was a really common tactic in the gay liberation movement that brought us marriage equality. And so what I would say is I have never seen more solidarity and unity within queer and trans communities than we see today. I have also never seen as much solidarity between feminist organizations and trans rights groups as we see today. We have learned from the failures of our past when our movements were not as united and intersectional, but we're coming together again for three things: a more free, equal, and socially just future, not just for gay folks, but for all folks.
I'm wondering a part of this too. I mean, you have Saskatchewan and Alberta passing laws. You just made a face. This is an audio medium. So I just want to narrate that a bit. But I mean, we also, Doug Ford here in Ontario, he has made statements that might suggest he might lean that way, but he also hasn't introduced laws or policy. And I guess when you're sort of like thinking about these things, you know, where do you put somebody like a Doug Ford that has shown sort of, I guess, leans a certain way, but is, I don't, maybe has the political instincts to know that that's not going to go down well in his own jurisdiction?
So I think, you know, we have a different socio-cultural political landscape here than what's going on in Alberta or Saskatchewan or New Brunswick. And I think there would have been a whole lot. Like, I think about the sex ed battles. We put him in his place. We had him back off and make sure that we had a sex ed curriculum that served all students. And so I think that we are, especially in Toronto, because like there's a lot of progressive organizing in that city. But I would actually say I was really, you know, Premier Ford said a couple weeks ago that his government is not following the path of Premier Danielle Smith and that they have no interest in it. And I think cited like there's other things voters are concerned about. And right. That was really reassuring to me because I think now you have one cohort of Canadian conservatism that wants to scratch the itch of far right extremism, of conspiracy, of like bashing down on those gay folks and those diverse communities. But I actually think we need those examples. And I'm not saying Ford is all of this because he is, I have many a feeling about the man. And the moment he has a new scandal, who knows what community he might decide to announce policy around.
Right.
But I think there the other conservatives and the one that, you know, I'm not a conservative and I, you know, I have my leanings, but I love the idea of a contemporary conservative party and movement that actually engages on the issues that Canadians care about and that leaves behind that social conservative, we're going to control you and tell you how to live your life through policy or through like the social environment that we create. I think that's a thing of the past. But I think a lot of these, you know, Premier Mo, Premier Higgs, Danielle Smith and Polyev, they are really trying to fight for that old school conservatism that wasn't good to gay people.
Right. I want to look at this at another way. You know, you and others are having to fight this battle. I mean, just essentially to be allowed to exist as you sort of want to exist. You made another face. But I mean, you know, there are real issues, like other issues of equality. You mentioned healthcare before. That's a massive one for trans people. I mean, what would you rather be fighting for right now as opposed to, you know, just trying to fight for your identity?
I would love for governments to be introducing services to help parents of trans kids. right? Like there's all this rhetoric around these parents right now. And actually we don't have the services so that if a parent's kid comes out as trans, that parent has support and that we invest in that healthy family relationship. That's what should have happened in Alberta. In the broader scope, you know, queer and trans communities are still, we are so recently out of the closet in the Canadian cultural context, right? Like we're talking maybe 25 years of progress on this, but it's only in like the last 10 to 15 that like the environment really did start to say, hey, gay folks, there's nothing wrong with y'all. And we actually still have to support the bringing along of fulsome equality. And that's by supporting local queer organizations like Kind Space and Max Ottawa here in my city that are there when a gay kid's kicked out of their home, that are there to help develop a next generation of queer workers who are more equal and who are able to meet their economic potential. And so it's all of that, the everyday business and policy work of undoing generations of inequality to unlock the potential culturally and economically of queer and trans people in Canada, because that's good for us and good for the country.
Right. That's an interesting point, too, because if it really is about sort of like, I mean, we can talk about whether and how much of it is about parental rights, but if it really is about helping parents and giving parents the tools, that's a piece of this that's really missing. Like I would like to think, I don't have any children, but if I did have a child and they were trans, I'd like to think I would support them wholeheartedly. But I, on the other hand, I wouldn't know where to begin, and I wouldn't know how to send that message to my child if I thought maybe they were of a different orientation, and how to, you know, and they would be worried about coming out and how I would be able to send that message that I want to support them. That seems like a big area that could be filled with education instead of this malice.
So, like, that's how we actually, like, again, so many of these trans kids are don't have great relationships with their families for a whole bunch of reasons. And these kids drop out sooner. They struggle with their mental health. And a lot of that is impacted by parental support. We know that strong bonds with parents absolutely plummets the rates of suicide, self-harm, depression, and everything for trans kids, because kids deserve healthy homes and happy families. And that's what we should be focused on, not this anti-trans dressed up parental rights stuff.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about sort of how you deal with these things as a trans woman yourself, because you're probably watching the calendar too, but it was almost 1 year ago Hershey committed the grievous crime of including you in the promotion of a chocolate bar. Mm-hmm. And that was not probably great for your mental health, some of the responses to that. So, I mean, sharing as much as you sort of feel comfortable, just, you know, how did you cope with that? And how do you continue to cope with like getting that online hate and all the trolls and things?
It was actually like, I think 2 days ago that I got the Facebook memory of when I first posted about my inclusion in the campaign. It was like, look, everybody, that was my day of hope, my day of optimism. And then what happened. And I got stomped on by the figureheads of far right from across North America. And I share this more frequently now, but I didn't at the time. But I had to have security guards for 7 days, like literally in front of my door. I was driven around in a bulletproof vehicle. I went to the grocery store and the security guards had to like blend in as everyday humans, like grocery shopping with me.
How did that go?
It was fun. It was like I saved a lot of money on Uber. That was great. Like outside the nice part of having, like, it was great of Hershey's to give me the security guards. And there was a lot of worry for my safety at that time. And, you know, I had Tucker Carlson, we showed a picture from my Instagram. And I'm a recent homeowner. And so soon before then, I posted a picture of my house. And that's a really scary thing to then have out in the world. And I did have far-right groups doxing me and looking at all the private info they could on me. They estimated my business or my economic worth as $1 million, my net worth. And I was like, oh, I'm so honored. I wish that was true. but like, you know, more really, like I was inundated with like a degree of hate and horror and filth that nothing could have ever prepared me for. I like broke down on my spouse's shoulder time after time after time. And it's been a nightmare because it hasn't gone away. Like it's decreased. There's a whole different thing when it's like Fox News, Tucker Carlson. But just a couple weeks ago, there was another Rebel News article about me, and then True North Center, and then all of these other folks on social media and in the far right world. Even, you know, Conservative Party of Canada comms press secretary trying to like slander me as a liberal shill because my organizations happen to receive public funds, just like the National Post, outlets across the country, and tons of profit and nonprofit organizations.
Yeah.
And so it's just frustrating, like, to have this be like my new normal and to have it actually not be condemned by our political spheres in the same way that we would condemn if like a cisgender straight lady was being harassed on social media and she had a role and platform like I do. On the other hand, I just like I sip my wine after hours. I hang out with my ferrets and I spend my time at drag shows because when the world is hard, go watch a drag performer do their thing and it'll cheer you up in ways you could never imagine.
Well, aside from that, and this is kind of one where I want to sort of wrap things up. You know, we've talked a lot about dour stuff the last 20 minutes or so. But, you know, when you're sitting back and you're having that glass of wine, what still gives you hope? What, you know, picks you up in terms of, you know, where the community is?
It's the young folks. You know, I remember I didn't come out as trans till I was 20. I came out as gay in high school and there were no out trans kids. And like the few gay kids were not well treated. Mm. And we still know there's like bullying and stuff at school in bad ways. But for the first time, we have a generation of young trans people who didn't have to unlearn as much as we did, who weren't bullied quite as much as we were. And those are young folks who are going to walk into our workplaces, walk into adulthood with their shoulders, you know, back with their head held high, and they're going to live their best lives. And so those kids and the tens of thousands of parents who support them, they're the ones that give me hope because they show we have come so darn far. And there is so much joy and power in the world we're making together.
Well, that's a great place to leave it on. Faye Johnstone, thank you so much for your time today. It's really appreciated.
This was a blast. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Okay, so that was Faye Johnstone, and you can find them on social media because you heard them. They are not leaving. So also, International Women's Day is a week tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So I know there's a lot of Guelph activities too, so I don't know them off the top of my head, but it's easy enough to find. There's usually a gathering around noon hour at Market Square, not my column, but the actual area in front of City Hall. Probably easy enough to Google and Facebook and find all those connections and stuff. So celebrate International Women's Day. Even if you're not a woman, it's still worth celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's it for this week's show and for my proselytizing. We hope you liked it. You can listen to our show again by downloading it every Monday from our website, opensourcesguelph.com. We're at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, and you can get us through your favorite app like Apple, Google, TuneIn, and Spotify. You can stay connected to us on social media. We're on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and we're on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. I shall return to CFRU Wednesday at 3 p.m. for the movie review show that I co-host called End Credits. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and you can check out my news and politics site at GuelphPolitico.ca.
And I'm Scott Hertz on Facebook, Twitter, and Blue Sky. And if you're joining us at a regular time on a Thursday at 5 o'clock, please stay tuned for something new and something different called the Volunteer Playlist.
It's exactly what it delivers exactly what it promises.
No explanation required.
That's one of the many programs that you can hear on this station, CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. As for this show, we will return next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more open sources, and we will, of course, see you then. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Justin Trudeau. You're listening to CFIU 93.3 Guelph Campus Radio.